He's saying, you know, you need to pay me these subsidies to keep these assets running, because otherwise you don't have energy security in this country.
Follow the money.
This is a podcast of the European investigative newsroom Follow the Money. In each edition, we dive into a recent investigation exposing Europe's power brokers. From deceiving companies and influential lobbyists to corrupt politicians and financial fraudsters. I'm your host, Emma Duchesnier, recording here from Brussels. And as usual, I'm joined by Follow the Money reporter and my co-host, Alexander Fanta in Vienna. Morning, Alex.
Hello, good morning.
In this episode, we're talking about Czech billionaire Daniel Křetínský. He's a man who not many of our listeners will know, but who has quietly become one of the most powerful figures in Europe. He's the continent's biggest coal burner, and he's also a business tycoon who's bought up major pieces of public life. From newspaper Le Monde in France, to the UK's Royal Mail, to football clubs like West Ham United. But, as our investigation shows, he's used his influence to his advantage. Despite this vast fortune, he's also receiving hundreds of millions in EU green subsidies. To unpack this story, we're joined by its two authors, investigative journalist Sofia Kerici, who's based in Istanbul, and Hazel Sheffield, an investigative journalist based in the UK, to follow the trails of this billionaire. Hazel, who is Daniel Křetínský and how did this man get so rich?
Well, Daniel Křetínský is a Czech billionaire and he has built his empire on fossil fuels. So it's a sector that he knows very well indeed. In 2013, his company bought a stake in Slovak Gas Industry, which is the primary gas utility in Slovakia, for 2.6 billion euros. And this was the beginning of a string of acquisitions in the Slovak energy market that gave him substantial influence over the Eurostream pipeline, which is the major pipeline that transports Russian gas through Ukraine to Europe. So this was the beginning of his huge fossil fuel empire. And he has since then acquired assets in dirty fuels, we would call them, in coal and gas in many other countries across Europe, especially in Germany, in the Netherlands too, in France, in the UK. And so he has become very rich from owning these assets, which we are desperately trying to phase out in Europe. But for many reasons, that process is going much slower than I think the policymakers would have hoped.
A central part of your investigation is biomass. What exactly is biomass?
It's a form of energy production that generates power from burning raw materials. What we focus on our investigation is basically biomass coming from wood. The EU and the EU and other energy providers, they tend to frame a biomass as this green miracle, whilst in reality, I mean, there are enormous criticalities in the way big scale biomass plants operate and their environmental impact.
What makes you say that biomass then in some cases isn't that green after all?
The assumption is that trees will grow back. But what activists and campaigners and many researchers point out that by the time the tree might regrow, you still have consumed and produced a lot of CO2. We know as a fact that burning wood produces more greenhouse gases than coal. So, for example, in France, we found that APH plants emit 4 times more CO2 than the national average of power plants producing energy in the country. There is really like a lot of controversy around it. There are also other problems, which is that the origins of the wood, of course, burned in these plants, it's often not discarded wood. We found that actually EPH burns healthy forest in some of its power plants, at least in the power plants that we investigated. So in France, for example, our colleague Aida Delpuec, she found that EPH sources about 30% from protected areas. Another example that we have is in Italy. Again, they declare that it's that the wood that they burn is base wood, but it's actually in all the documents that we reviewed, it's clearly stated that it is a virgin wood, which I mean can be so many things because it's a very vague term, but it definitely cannot be waste wood.
So, and what's it like for people living near these EPH biomass plants? Are they noticing any effects health-wise, environmentally?
In some cases, they emit notable levels of CO2. and also other kind of emitters and pollutants. In Italy, in Calabria, what we found is actually that there are some of the most polluting and carcinogenic elements, PM10 and PM2.5. They are both exceeding the daily legal limits with an average of from 7 to 10 times annually. So it is very relevant also for the local communities. We shared also this piece of information with one of the researchers at Biofuel Watch, and she really said, like, this is very bad. Because already the legal limits are very high. These legal limits are really like a compromise. If you're exceeding them, it really means that, I mean, there is something much worse going on there. It's problematic for your health.
But how is that possible, Sophia? I mean, isn't there rules, isn't there laws against that kind of thing?
Yes, this is the whole problem. There are rules, of course, but the problem is the implementation of it, and that there are no, there is really little monitoring. EPH has built a billion euro business model that exploits these loopholes and these ambiguities, the ambiguities of this EU's EU energy transition policy. The system is so very complex, and the supply chain lacks proper monitoring from public authorities.
So what you're saying is your investigation really focused primarily on EPH, Daniel Krutinsky's company, but you're saying that his way of going about biomass in reality is an illustration of what's actually going wrong at the EU level.
Yeah, exactly.
Within the energy sector, Krutinsky isn't just active in biomass, he's also heavily invested in coal.
Exactly. EPH is also one of the main emitters of greenhouse gases and the biggest coal producer in Europe.
And he argues that the EU should stick to coal, actually, and delay its green targets. What's his logic in that sense, Hazel?
Yes, so this was actually the starting point for our article on Follow the Money, because we got a rare glimpse into Krutinsky's ideas around this earlier this year, just after the German elections. He wrote an op-ed, if you like, an opinion piece in a German newspaper, and he revealed his feelings about European energy policy. It appeared in Die Welt, and he asked Brussels to delay what he called unrealistic carbon emissions targets. So it was quite a long article, but in its essence, he was saying that Europe was neglecting its own prosperity in the name of its climate change ideology, and that Brussels needs a new strategy to reset its targets, to keep using gas and fossil fuels until particularly green hydrogen is cheaper. He's a huge proponent of green hydrogen, and also to invest billions in gas outside of Europe.
But Hazel, I guess it stands to reason that he himself would profit quite a bit from delaying those targets.
Absolutely, yeah. So one of the people I spoke to was a French biographer of his who described him as ruthless when it comes to business. So his first ambition is to make money, right? And that seems to be the thing to understand about Krutinsky. He knows that Europe is already failing on the energy targets that it wanted to see. And perhaps he thinks the writing is on the wall, and it's simply pragmatic to encourage Europe to delay its targets and to pay him lots of money to keep his fossil fuel plants open.
So it's very much not just the way that he views things. It's actually a strategic bet that he's doing here.
Well, yeah, he bills himself not as a radical. You know, he's not saying, you know, climate change is rubbish. He's just saying this is pragmatic. And that word actually appears 9 times in that one article, the word pragmatic. So he's trying to say, you know, this is a moderate view that we need to keep this balanced investments, because we are just not going to make our green energy targets anyway.
I think this whole argument that the EU has been sacrificing its own prosperity, its own wealth in the name of climate change, I think that's an argument that's starting to really resonate here in Brussels. Alex, how do you look at that? Is there truth in that line of logic?
It certainly is for some of the far-right politicians who got voted into parliament last year. So last year's European election saw big gains for the and anything from the far right to more centrist, more moderate, but still hardline conservative voices. And they have been pushing for a rollback of green rules on the European level. So we've seen pushback against the recent law against deforestation. We have seen a big push to kind of tone down climate goals up to 2040. And this narrative that, you know, we need to be pragmatic, there's a big overshoot in our efforts to curb carbon emissions, that has been kind of a major talking point for many people on the right. We're here in a situation where a lot of people in the energy sector have made investments in fossil fuels that if the phase out goes as planned or even sooner, they would stand to lose a lot of money. So every year that they can extend their coal plants, for instance, that just is extra profit.
Krutinski is quite firmly on the side of fossil fuels. You know, there's a campaign group called Beyond Fossil Fuels who have said that EP Group has the worst decarbonization plans of five of the major energy companies in Europe, including Enel in Italy, Energie in France, Norway's Statkraft. So this was just last year. So Krutinski is really staying on the side of the fact that he believes Europe will need fossil fuel for longer than it expects.
And so far, we've mainly talked about Krutinski's grip on the energy sector. But as your article shows, he also has a grip in other sectors. Where else does this man have influence?
Yeah, so perhaps not to be unexpected for a man of his great wealth. He has invested heavily in other sectors as well. And we saw this particularly during coronavirus. So, you know, huge market downturns during the pandemic that Krutinski leveraged quite cleverly to acquire what were at the time undervalued assets. But these were often in sectors that are quite essential or key to the running of countries. So logistics and essential services. He also has shares in Sainsbury's, the second largest UK supermarket chain. He's increased his shares in Metro, in fact, the German wholesale retailer. So he owns 40%, I think, at the moment. And he has large investments in the logistics sector, which obviously during the pandemic we relied upon to get food to our front doors. So he's a major shareholder in IDS, which is the parent company of the 500-year-old British Postal Service, a deal that caused enormous hand-wringing in the newspapers and among politicians when it went through last year, I think. And he also has a large stake in the Dutch postal and logistics company, PostNL. And he's increased that stake as well. So these are really important sectors. You know, in banking, there's that phrase, too big to fail. I think we can see how Krutinski would be able to receive public subsidy in order to keep some of these really key industrial players going if they were, for any reason, to become under threat.
And aside from having become incredibly rich because of his enormous business empire, he's also gotten a lot of EU subsidies. And Sophia, why would the EU give him money and what for?
Well, Emma, as you mentioned, EPH, the biggest energy group in Central Europe, is owned by Daniel Krutinski. And it's one of the largest biomass operations in Europe. Now, the EU invests billions in renewable energy subsidies. And EPH gets a portion of this through a bunch of biomass power plants scattered throughout different locations in Europe. They suck up huge amounts of green subsidies from national governments. We calculated that in 2024 alone, EPH biomass plants we investigated in four countries, UK, France, Czech Republic, and Italy, they received at least 255 million euros in subsidies. Subsidies that we have to remember are meant to incentivize the production of green energy.
And when one billionaire has his fingers in so many things, from the energy that goes into our houses to what we see on our newsfeed, should we be worried?
Well, I think the worry comes when billionaires own enough assets to be able to get the business decisions that they want to see through parliaments. And it may be hard to see, even through our investigation, it was very hard to see how that was happening, that kind of lobbying thing at a European level, although we did try really hard to prove that. We are certainly colleagues of ours in Czech Republic have seen how Kuczynski's ownership of assets in different sectors can affect or can impact political decisions, especially in media. So yeah, Kuczynski was for a while, or his business was for a while, a shareholder in Le Monde in France, but in the Czech Republic, the last July in 2024. When the Czech government was trying to pass key climate documents through a legislative process, Kuczynski's media house published a coordinated campaign that actually forced the government to postpone these targets. So there were these articles in the press calling the energy deal, the EU Green Deal, a green terror, green apocalypse, saying we'll pay up until we're green. And so in the end, the government kind of U-turned immediately and said actually that they were U-turning because of pressure from the media and that they were going to postpone passing some of the documents. And some of them still haven't been passed. So we can see there how owning different assets can achieve goals that benefit other assets.
Yeah, I think media ownership is really interesting in that respect, because it's quite often that when, you know, a very influential billionaire with a big kind of diversified group of holdings starts getting into media, that it's a clear sign that there might be an ulterior motive that goes beyond, the interest in making money with the media business. So media is a portal of entry into politics. It's a form of lobbying that it cannot be sanctioned easily. So I think that it's quite interesting. I think everyone can draw their own conclusions from that. But it's certainly one angle to watch when looking at Mr. Kretinsky.
And Hazel, you mentioned before this line of arguing like his businesses have become too big to fail. I imagine, does that actually mean that maybe the government is almost like in a position where they have to keep giving him these subsidies because he essentially controls the energy sector to such an extent that he could actually cut off energy from our houses?
Who knows? It's certainly what he's arguing in the Netherlands, especially. You know, he's saying, you know, you need to pay me these subsidies to keep these assets running, because otherwise you don't have energy security in this country. And we saw this also with his investment in PostNL, that he's asking for subsidies in order to keep that business running. You know, a key part of logistics, a key part of keeping parcels traveling in the Netherlands. So. I think he is betting that these businesses are profitable for him because they are too big to fail.
All right. And that's where we'll leave it for today's episode. Thank you so much for joining us, Hazel and Sophia. Alex and I will be back soon for another episode. And you can find this story in the show notes and also on our website, of course, ftm.eu.
You've listened to the podcast of Follow the Money. Our watchdog journalism is funded by our members. Subscribe and support European investigative journalism.